So this morning we're going to talk about personal evolution and planetary evolution. And since we probably feel a little less responsibility for the planetary part, I'll start with that. So most of you know and have had fairly extensive classes and exposure to the yugas, but I'll just touch on them briefly and try to bring in some new thoughts and some thoughts from Master on them that we may not have heard. Master gave a very interesting talk in 1940, which was at the beginning of the Second World War, when it really looked like, you know, it was terrible times ahead. And the title of the talk was, When Will the Earth End? Because that theme was very much on people's minds. And he began the talk by saying, you know, these things are in God's hands, and there's such a thing as partial dissolution of the earth, which is loss of culture, loss of when the environment goes haywire and so on. And then complete dissolution. He said we don't need to worry about complete dissolution of the earth. That's very, very far in the future. And it basically occurs when everybody on earth is in samadhi and God no longer has any use for this planet as a school, as a classroom. And so he takes the classroom away. But we're a ways away from that. So we don't need to worry about that. But he did talk about partial dissolution, and he talked about it not only in terms of the planet, but also in terms of our own lives and so on. That he made a number of very interesting statements in that talk. One, he said that this time period that we're in, Dwapara Yuga, will not be a safe time period. It's a time period that in some ways is more dangerous than Kali Yuga, basically because our consciousness has not advanced very much. And I'll cover these yugas, but Kali Yuga is the dark age, which we've just come out of, and now we're in the next age, Dwapara Yuga, which is the age of energy. And he said that the reason in a certain sense that it's less secure during Dwapara Yuga. We are advancing. The world is advancing. The planetary consciousness is rising. But it hasn't risen very much yet. And you can do a whole lot more damage with a hydrogen bomb than you can with a battle axe. And so because of that, because of bombs, because of the use, we're coming into the age of energy. We're in the age of energy. And the weapons, as well as the good parts, will reflect the age of energy that we're in. And so the battle axes and swords and bows will be transiting into atomic bombs or bombs of energy, lasers, robots, all of that, all of it. And he said that after the war is over, he said the use of electricity as technology will begin to really come into common usage. And it was after the Second World War when television really came into the world. It had been invented earlier, but in 1943, hardly anyone, or 45, hardly anyone had a television set. So it was after the war that the beginning of mass media and mass electronic media. There had been radio, but radio is, of course, as we all know, much less engrossing than television is. And so television came in, and then the internet and computers and all of that. I won't go into that very much. But Let me just cover a little bit. Another thing he said, though, which was interesting, this was in 1940, he said that because of karmic patterns in the world, the time is coming very soon when India and other countries that have been oppressed by conquerors will become free. And it was in 1948 that India gained its freedom. So he was making these predictions that, looking back at that talk, which is, you know, now, what is it, 75 years ago or 76 years ago, we can see that those predictions are all coming true. Just interesting, because we who have faith in Master know that he's going to speak the truth. But it's interesting to see it in print from a talk in 1940. So let me cover the yugas and cover a little bit from what Master talks about. I'll start, unlike the way we usually start, I'll start at the bottom. So the very darkest time, the yugas are like it's been called the great year. It's a great cycle. It's a cycle of 24,000 years. And that cycle, just like the seasons, repeats itself over and over and over again, except that the seasons all happen within our lifetime, and they happen repeatedly within a single lifetime. So it's easy to recognize that winter is followed by spring, and spring by summer, and summer by fall, and then by winter again, because we see that. But if we only lived for one day in December, it would be hard to perceive the flow of those seasons, wouldn't it? And so if someone came and said, oh no, it's not always like this. You see, it gets warmer and then warmer, the big cycle, and say, well, he's okay. You know, so when Sri Yukteswar came along in the late 1800s and gave there was the understanding that something was cyclical, but in India, the knowledge of what was really going on had been lost. And so these cycles were thought to be hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. And so Kali Yuga was going to last for 435,000 years. And when Sri Yukteswar had his kind of revolutionary theory that it was a 24,000 year cycle, and we were actually out of Kali Yuga and in Dwapara Yuga, he had a little march through the streets. And that theory was so radical that people threw rocks at him. Kind of, you know, heretic. And so, but he revised our thinking on that. So we have this 24,000 year cycle. And starting at the bottom, we have a half cycle descending and then a half cycle ascending. And so starting at the bottom, which is about 500 AD, we have gone through the descending cycle of the lowest age of four ages, Kali Yuga. And so Kali Yuga lasts 1,200 years. So from 500, you go back to about 700 BC, and you have the descending cycle of Kali Yuga. Then you have an ascending cycle of Kali Yuga, again 1,200 years. So you add 1,200 to 500, and you get 1,700. So the end of Kali Yuga was about 1,700. And it was at that time that we saw a great explosion. You know, we had Galileo, who said that the sun was... the earth was not the center of the solar system. The sun did not revolve around the earth. That the sun was the center of our solar system and the earth revolved around that. Well, that was radical enough so that he was declared a heretic by the Catholic Church, because the knowledge of these fundamental things that today we all accept as being obvious was not yet there. It was Kali Yuga. Now, I don't know whether this is true, but things are very fixed, very unchanging in Kali Yuga. I don't know whether this is true, but I read that for a period of about 600 years, the most important invention during Kali Yuga was the wheelbarrow, which allowed men to take a load off their back and put it in something that they could push. 600 years. Now, I don't know that they had trade shows in those days the way we do now, but things didn't change very much because one of the absolute characteristics of Kali Yuga is things are very fixed. Everything is fixed, including religion is very fixed. Everything refers to form. The understanding that anything beyond this physical world has reality is just not there in people's minds. And so even the churches, you go into churches that are built from that time on, medieval churches and older ones, and you see that even the churches are built in such a way that in order to inspire you, in order to lift your consciousness, they have a physical spire that you look up and you see something very high and very tall and it kind of lifts your consciousness. But it's done through physical means. And man's place in the world is very fixed. Most people never moved farther, never traveled farther than 25 miles from the place that they were born. The occupations of people were very fixed. You were what your father was. So, you know, if your father was iron worker, a smithy, you were Smith. You were the son of Smith, and you were a Smith too, and so on. And the caste system in India, which had come from ancient times, had frozen into kind of occupational and rigid castes. Now, we're coming out of that, but we're not very far out of that. So at any rate, coming up to about 1700 or so, the world began to shift rapidly. The Industrial Revolution had come in. The early explorers, Columbus and some others, had begun to travel far enough so that they came back with news, worldwide news, that there was a whole world out there that we hadn't explored. So people's understanding spatially was expanding very rapidly. And one of the keynotes of what happens during Dwapara Yuga is that the delusion of space is going to disappear. But first you have to have a concept of space before it can disappear. And when space is only 25 miles, or you hear of somebody who has traveled, you know, all the way to from Arabia, and they've come to see the king, you know, the concept of how big the world is still very small. So we've come out of that age where things are very fixed. One way that I like to think of it is that age is the four ages are like the four stages of water. That age is like ice. And with ice, you can cut things into nice little blocks. You can move them apart. You can put them somewhere. They stay where you put them. You don't have to worry so much. People stay in their places. You don't have to worry about them so much. And if they don't stay in their places, then you hit them over the head with some solid object that makes them go back into their place. So you've got this very nice fixed world. We have moved out of that, and the keynote of the age that we're in, Dwapara Yuga, is the age of energy. And so there's a little bit of a transition time, a kind of there's a dawn at the beginning of a new age and a twilight at the end of it. So from 1700 to 1900 was a little bit of a twilight of, it was Dwapara Yuga, but kind of just coming into its being. 1900 was around the time, 1906, that Einstein gave the great theory of relativity, which showed that energy and matter were actually the same thing. They were interchangeable. E equals mc squared, mass equals matter times the square of the speed of light. Isn't that interesting? But at any rate, during that beginning of what we can call Dwapara proper, 1900, which is just when Master incarnated, isn't it? Just a few years before that. So our line of masters are Dwapara Yuga masters. Our country was founded in 1776. We're a Dwapara Yuga country. And we don't have, like India and Europe and most of the rest of the world, this long tail of kind of baggage that we're dragging behind us. You know, in America, the oldest building we can look at is maybe from the 1600s. We had a friend of ours was sitting in a piazza in Assisi, the central piazza there, having a coffee with a friend, and he asked the waiter, "Is that building across the street very old?" And the waiter said, "Oh no, it's not very old. I think it's only 1200 or 1250. You know, so the different concept of time when you have a continuous culture. So America does not have a continuous culture, a continuous history that is present in our minds. And that frees us to be a Dwapara Yuga nation. And that's one of the reasons that America is going to help lead the world in this age of Dwapara Yuga. Master said that America and India combined, because America represents the efficiency, material efficiency at its height, and India represents spirituality, and those two will come together in this age of Dwapara Yuga. So let's fast forward at least into the age that we're at now. We see increasing use of electricity and electronics. We see increasing shrinking of the concept of space, especially if you have a cell phone. When that cell phone rings, you know, you can be anywhere in the world, and the cell phone rings, and you pull it out of your pocket. You don't know whether somebody is calling you from downstairs or from on the other side of the world. The phone just rings. So that 25-mile space has basically disappeared. It's almost meaningless in our current time. So space disappears. The interaction becomes increasingly through electronic means. But more importantly, those nice ice cubes that used to stay in their place, they're melting. And water does not stay in its place. It wants to cross borders. And so if you want to keep it in its place, you campaign that you're going to build an enormous fence and keep all those foreigners in their place on the other side, because things want to shift. And if you're fixed with your religion, then you become very, very fanatical, because your religion, the fuzzy edges, the hard edges of your religious beliefs are beginning to melt, and they're coming under attack. And so you're trying to freeze it. And if you look at the Taliban, one of the main things is that they want to keep women in their place. They don't want to educate the young girls because they know if they do that, it's going to get fuzzy around the edges. They're supposed to have a certain role and they're supposed to stay in that role. And we'll kill off anybody that doesn't believe that way. And so I don't want to drill down. I just want to set the stage that in the age that we're in, it is going to be very changeable and relatively insecure because the old Kali Yuga ways have not yet completely disappeared. The old Kali Yuga thinking is still present. It's a minority now, but it's present. And yet it's being energized by the heightened energy of Dwapara Yuga. As Devi once famously said, it's like dinosaurs on steroids. So those old forms are very, very active in the world. And so we look and we think, oh my God, the world is just going to the dogs. It's deteriorating. It's terrible. When in fact, the opposite is true. You know, we look and we think, oh gosh, there's so much violence in the world. The actual likelihood of you dying, of a person on the planet dying, as a percentage of the population, is way, way, way down from where it was in Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, somewhere between 10 and 15% of the people died through violence, through war, whatever. Now it's down like 1% or 2%. But the media, remember space, when your world was only 25 miles around, somebody 30 miles away could die in a raid by the Vikings, and you wouldn't maybe even hear about it. Now somebody falls down a step and breaks their ankle in Florida, and it's all over the airwaves if that person is a musician or a movie star. You know, so the media has expanded our connection in such a way that we think that things are much, much worse than they are. You know, the mind has a little trick, a nasty trick. It remembers negative things 7 times more powerfully than positive things. So if you have a conversation with somebody and it's a beautiful conversation, you don't remember that. You can have 6 of those. And then you have one conversation where that friend says, I don't think that color looks very good on you. And all the other 6 are gone. All you remember is, why in the world should that person be criticizing the way I'm dressed? I mean, and so Master said that's why we don't remember our incarnations. Because we would remember all the negative things. We wouldn't remember the good parts. That's why God obscures it from us. And so at any rate, the point that I'm getting to here, which has become very obscure, is that things are getting better, but the tendency of the mind is to look only at the negative things. And that's exacerbated by the media, which professionally collects all the negative things in order to present to us. And so we get the impression that things are worse than they are, but they're actually getting better. And so things will continue to improve, but it will not be a safe time because the consciousness hasn't risen enough. Now I'll touch just very briefly on the next 2 ages. So electricity, energy, shrinking of space or expansion of space is the keynote of Dwapara Yuga and the dissolution of forms. In Treta Yuga, the next yuga, Dwapara Yuga is 2,400 years. Kali Yuga is 12. Fortunately, the good ages last increasingly longer than the bad ones. Kali Yuga is 1,200, going up now. Dwapara Yuga will be the next 2,400. Treta Yuga will be the next 3,600 years. During Treta Yuga, the keynote is not electricity, it's mental power. So we won't need to use phones, we'll communicate mentally. And Swami has written that he's quite convinced that the pyramids, which probably go back to Treta Yuga, were not built physically, not built, I hate to admit it, but I'm going to admit publicly that Davy and I once watched a movie called 10,000 BC. And even more disastrously, we watched it all the way through. But we did learn some very interesting scientific facts there. That the pyramids were built by woolly mammoths dragging those stones up ramps. And so I just pass that on for your enlightenment. Now, Swami, heretic that he is, didn't believe in the woolly mammoth theory of the pyramids and felt that they were built by mantra and mind power. See, in higher ages, in this age, mantras just seem like somebody saying a bunch of words. In higher ages, where there's real mental power, remember, the words that you say are expressions of your consciousness. So when your consciousness is powerful and clear, then those words have power. And you can use them to lift stones, to move things around, to do all kinds of things. And so during Treta Yuga, the delusion of time begins to disappear. And so from Treta Yuga, we have things like the Book of Bhrigu and other predictions where Davy and I had an incredible reading from, like Bhrigu, but Nadi. And it was like it was on palm leaves or
banana
leaves written in Sanskrit that were several hundred years old. And it was like somebody had been following our life and just wrote it out. You know, your son has recently gone through a separation. He's worried, and his two children, and just went on like that with the family, with health. Told me exactly what was going on with my health, and Davy's health part said she eats her food too quickly. Now, I'm in big trouble after this.
Wait till she speaks next.
Yeah, right. Those eyes, you know. At any rate, reminds me of a joke. A friend of ours told us in India. He said, this young man, teenager says, I want to die peacefully in my sleep like my grandfather did. Not screaming in terror, like the passengers in the car he was driving. So at any rate, coming back, so in Treta Yuga, the delusion of time disappears, and so whoever was writing that, probably students of Sukdeva is the line that it comes from, students of Sukdeva, didn't have the same delusion that things were happening in the future. Master said that time is like a movie reel, and we only think that it's linear because the frames go one at a time. But if you don't think that the frames have to go one at a time, you can go to any frame that you want to, And it's all omnipresent. It's all there. And so time disappears. In Satya Yuga, so the age of Treta Yuga is the age of mental powers. In Satya Yuga, the age is basically one of unity with God. You see that it's spiritual consciousness that is everywhere, omnipresent. Master said that many, many people will be freed during Satya Yuga. But he said, you don't want to wait around to get born in the right yuga, because you'll just keep getting born in the yuga that you deserve to be born in. Now, that doesn't apply to everyone. See, we can move around in the yugas, and that comes more to our personal evolution, because basically the people in this room are not Kali Yuga people. Most people on the planet are not, but there are still some. The people in this room are not even Dwapara Yuga people. We're Satya Yuga, maybe Treta Yuga people, but we're, or at the very least, advanced Dwapara Yuga people, because we're leading our lives trying to use energy to dissolve the consciousness that this body is real. Now, that's actually a Satya Yuga. We're trying to see ourselves and everyone else and everything as simply an expression, an extension of the consciousness of God. That's a Satya Yuga trait, not a Dwapara Yuga trait. And so we're really Satya Yuga people who are a little displaced in time, because we have a mission to do. Master came. Now, Master was not a Kali Yuga person when he was William the Conqueror. He wasn't a Dwapara Yuga person when he was Paramahansa Yogananda. He was beyond all of this. But he came into this age, as did this whole line of masters, with a particular mission to do, which is to help move the consciousness of the whole planet from Kali Yuga into Dwapara Yuga proper. And so all of our techniques are techniques using energy. That's why we've been talking the last 2 days about all of the aspects of energy. Will, what is will? Energy directed toward a goal. And all of the techniques involve will. So Master's teachings are high teachings, but clothed more or less in the words that we can understand and that large numbers of people can understand. Just as Jesus was not a Kali Yuga avatar, he was way beyond that. But if he had begun to speak in terms of when you pull out your cell phone, not many people would relate to that. And because that age was one of fixity, not many people could relate to. I have a little beeper on my watch, which keeps me from talking too long. So he had to teach according to the consciousness that was there, as does Master. But we have an evolutionary arc that is beyond these ages. And so all of us want to go beyond the limitations of the age that we're in, and we want to become Satya Yuga consciousness and go into samadhi. Now, I'll end with this. I had an interesting insight this morning. Some of you who have studied more of the technical things of yoga, I don't know that it's absolutely true or not, but it was interesting. All of a sudden, I was thinking about the yugas, and I was thinking about Patanjali's Eightfold Path, and they follow the yugas. So the fundamentals, yama and niyama, and I'm not going to explain all this, either you know it or you don't, yama and niyama are kind of the foundation, because they relate to how we as an individual relate to the world around us. But then after that, you don't need to relate to the world around you. You begin asana. Asana is like Kali Yuga aspect. It's your physical body, which you have to hold still in order for higher states to come. And one of the difficulties, one of the things that poor Gyandev has been fighting for 20 years, he's on the board of directors of the Yoga Alliance, he's been fighting for 20 years against the postures, yoga postures, becoming too fixed in the physicality of it all. And because Swami and Ananda's path tries to see the yoga postures not as physical, not as Kali Yuga, but as a means of changing consciousness. So then the next is, for Dwapara Yuga, what could be more appropriate than pranayama, the control of prana? That's the age that we're in. That's why our techniques are pranayama techniques. The next is pratyahara, which is the withdrawal of the senses, shutting off the sense telephones, Master said. When you're no longer deluded that you need the senses to communicate with the world, you communicate through your mental powers. And then the last three, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, are lumped together even by Patanjali called samyama. And that's satya yuga, where you concentrate, you become absorbed, and then you become one with everything. So I don't know whether it's valid, but it seems valid to me that this teaching, ancient teaching of Patanjali, also follows this same rhythm that the yugas follow, that our evolution follows, that it's all tied together. It's one God who has created everything. And you find, I'm always have fun finding reflections from one area in, you know, the connections in another area. But it's basically all tied together and all one. And when we can recognize that, then we will achieve the purpose of our being born, which is to go into samadhi and merge back to God.
Rebuttal time.
Yes. I'm now in trouble.
Well, I always find it comforting that in the higher ages in Satya Yuga, that technology has fallen away. And we have a wonderful phone system at Ananda Village that is inclusive here. We call it Ananda Bell. And our wonderful friend and helper and guru bhai, Rick Morehouse, keeps it going against all odds. But he often, very patiently, without any reflection of what a stupid idiot you are, explains to me how to change a phone message, how to change the, you know, all the different aspects that I never quite get. And then finally, once he said to me, "You know, Davey, I think this is the most advanced age yuga technically you've ever lived in." He didn't say whether it was Kali Yuga or Satya Yuga. I like to think it was Satya Yuga. So just to say, if you call us and the answering machine, the message on the answering machine says, "Hello, this is 2010. We're not home right now." I tried to change it, but I just couldn't. Actually, what you will hear is Rick's voice with the saying, "Okay." So Jyotish was talking about the great cycles of the yugas. In Swami's great, great book, to my mind, the greatest of everything he's done, The Essence of the Bhagavad Gita, he talks at length, expounds at length, based on Master's commentaries of the Gita, on the concept of the gunas, which is a reoccurring theme in the Bhagavad Gita. The gunas can be translated as qualities, those qualities which are manifested in various forms and expressions, and there are three of them, in every aspect of creation. So the three gunas, probably most of you know it, but we'll be talking about them, I'll touch lightly, in terms of personal and global evolution. So there's tamoguna, the dark quality, downward pulling, deadening, inertia. And there's rajaguna, the activating quality. And then sattvaguna, the elevating, upward propelling quality. And these three are always, Swami coined a remarkable phrase which one could actually meditate on for a long time. He called them the eternal wanderers, because they're always moving and changing and being reflected in different ways. And he said there are even whole galaxies that are predominantly one or the other. There are tamasic galaxies where they're brutish and wild animals are prevalent everywhere and cannibalism prevails and so forth. There are rajasic galaxies, and those are where very active, where the keynote is self-advancement and self-aggrandizement even, and self-importance. And Master says, unfortunately, the Milky Way in which we live is one such galaxy, predominantly rajaguna. And then there are sattvic galaxies, where one might think of them as like gardens of Eden, where there is peace and harmony, easy communion with the astral world. But Swami goes on a little bit. He said, looking at the way Sri Yukteswar describes our position in the solar system from the galactic center, which determines the spiritual consciousness of the individual planets, Swamiji says, I believe that Earth is a rajasic planet in a rajasic galaxy in a rajasic age. And here we are. triple blows there. Because each age, each of the four yugas, is predominantly one or the other also. Kali Yuga, you can, now you're wondering, but wait a minute, there's only three qualities and there are four ages. Master solve that, don't worry. We'll read, as they say so wonderfully and frequently in Italy, stai calmo, which never works anyway. But anyway, the Kali Yuga is basically a tamasic yuga. As Jyotish said, not moving of energy, fixed, downward pulling, violent. Then we come to our yuga, Dwapara Yuga, which is rajasic, active, movement, energy. And then we come to, and this is the thing that Master did so beautifully, he said there's a subcategory of the gunas, and he called it rajasattva. That's Treta Yuga, where there's still energy, but it's upward moving. And then finally, Satya Yuga, where there is no technology, where where we don't need to wear over-the-ear microphones. We just project our thoughts. It's so much simpler. And that is where everyone easily slips into awareness of God consciousness. And someone asked Master, well, if all the people, will all the people incarnated now, if they find God, will they have to come back again in Kali Yuga? He said, oh, or, you know, depending on what cycle that it is when they're reborn. He said, oh, no, they can be born on another planet, which is, again, a great comfort, that we don't need to be going through up and down our own spiritual development will move us to the right place at the right time. Okay. So these gunas are always at play, and they're at play in these great cosmic cycles. But here we are in the middle of, as we said, a Rajasic age and a Rajasic galaxy on a Rajasic planet. But we are also at a pivotal time. The shifting of the yugas, whether it's from Kali to Dwapara, Dwapara to Treta, is always a time of special moment, of special significance, because the energy is shifting there. Even coming down the other side of the cycle, even from coming down from Treta to Dwapara. So here we are in what might think is a pretty bad time to be around, but not so. And this is why our line of masters have come at this time, because it is a shifting of the ages. And when you look historically when they have come, the story of Kurukshetra and the Bhagavad Gita took place almost the opposite. It was coming down from Dwapara into Kali. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dwapara into Kali. And that's when Master was Arjuna, Krishna, Babaji were all there. And so they're always present at the changing of the ages. And it's fascinating that Swamiji has a really mind-expanding talk that he gave called Kriya Yoga in the Modern Age. And he said that Babaji perceived that there were souls in the West, particularly in America, at this time, who are yearning for a technique to help them reinvigorate their religious, their spiritual life. Because at this time in history, science has become predominant. And religion is not thought of with the same elevated respect that it had been in the past. And so Babaji heard the yearning of Westerners for a technique of religion, the science of religion, which was Master's keynote talk when he came to America. That's why they came, to bring the science of religion that the Western world was yearning, to balance materialistic science and practical spirituality, not just go to church, do this, do that, and you'll go to heaven. People didn't want that anymore. We wanted, let's stop putting it in the past and far away, we wanted a kind of approach to religion that would equal the power and clarity and predictable results that science was having. Now, there's a story that many of us know who have been around a long time at Ananda. Swami told it, Jyotish told the true story. But we have a new generation. And so I'm going to initiate you into the mysteries of the turtle story. Some of you don't know it, but some of you do. But at the beginning of the century, this is a true story, just to show the grip, the change from fundamentalism, fundamental religion, when science was starting to break through and destroy kind of fixed beliefs. There was an astronomer, William James, the brother of the author, Henry James. And he began talking about the solar system. He would travel around the country and give talks about the sun and the planetary positions and the revolving of the earth around the sun. And this was a new concept to a lot of people. And at one of his lectures afterwards, a little old lady came up to him and said, "Mr. James, you shouldn't talk all that nonsense about the earth going around the sun. You know it's not true." And he said, "Well, what do you think is true, ma'am?" And she said, "The earth is just some dirt resting on the back of a turtle." And Henry William James said, "Well, ma'am, what is that turtle resting on?" And she said, "It's resting on the back of another turtle." And he went on a couple of times through this. Then finally, he said, "But, you know, ma'am, what's that bigger turtle finally resting on?" And she said, "It's no use, Mr. James. It's turtles all the way down." So we're passing this esoteric information on to a new generation. But the point being, science came out, emerged when to solve the rigidity of Kali Yuga. But then it took over. And it said, all those beliefs, you can't prove that God is there. How do you know your prayers are answered? How do you know that God's inside of you? How do you know that Jesus even was what they say he was? And so we were yearning, our souls, whether we were aware of it or not, show us the way that we can disprove all the rigidity of religion and get to the heart of it. You know, I had been at Ananda a year or two. I had had a good education all my life. I'd graduated from college and so forth. But there was always some part of me that knew, but I had no way of approaching it, that what I had learned wasn't the ultimate truth. And then I came to Ananda and began practicing and studying. But then I remember it was one Christmas. I think it was the second year after I'd been here, Missouri. And I brought with me, then it was called Out of Crises in Modern Thought. Now it's called Out of the Labyrinth. And I started reading that book. And it was, there I was in my parents' living room. And it was as though all of a sudden everything I'd learned my whole life was put into perspective and showed to be not untrue, but lesser, not the ultimate truth. And I read it and I thought, this is what I was waiting to learn and no one ever told me. Just that things aren't rigid, they aren't fixed, that survival of the fittest is not the last word of evolution, but it's directional evolution of consciousness. And that we can never come to the end of it. It goes on, as Master said, it goes on until we achieve endlessness. And so this time where Kriya Yoga was given the technique that souls were yearning for in the West, it's very interesting that, and Babaji perceived this, told Sri Yukteswar at the Kumbh Mela, I'm going to be sending you, 1894, I'm going to be sending you a disciple in the future, and he will disseminate Kriya Yoga in the West. And years went by, and years went by, and then 1910, I believe it was, Sri Yukteswar said to Master, he was with him, you are that disciple that was predestined to answer the call. But we need to understand, and this is the beautiful thing that I find quite thrilling, there was the individual call of the souls of Westerners, but also coincided with a changing of consciousness. So it isn't just like, okay, these random people happen to be wanting an answer. It was coinciding with this evolution of Dwapara Yuga, where it was there was inevitably, impersonally, not based on the desires or interests of any one person, that it was coming about. And Swami Kriyananda, I just want to read this one passage to you because it is so, it says it far better than I can. This is, just briefly I'll read. Kriya as a tool for world evolution. The teaching of Kriya Yoga is destined to change the world, to bring it into a new age. I say that with total conviction. This teaching has been sent for that purpose. It has brought the central insights and the central technique, which, even with a small number of people practicing it, will change the whole populace. With a small minority of people practicing Kriya Yoga, we are going to see changes so deep and so far-reaching that 100 years from now, this won't be the same world we now know. It will be a world in which people's consciousness causes them to see things in a new way. It will have a religion that begins with the individual, with self-realization, not with a structure or an institution. Those things are useful and have their place, but the essence of religion will begin with the individual, with his own experience of truth. It will begin in his own center, in the spine. It will radiate outward from there, and from that change will come any changes that will take place in the world outside. This new consciousness will find its way instinctively into every field of human endeavor. It will change the way we approach the arts, politics, and government and science. It will change business practices and the way people live together in communities. I know what I'm saying. I know that it's true. We all need to do our little bit to bring these changes about, but not in a sense of messianic zeal, because what we're doing is going within and changing ourselves. We need to radiate outward from our center real joy and love. The more we live like that, the more other people will catch on and practice these teachings and be changed themselves. Very powerful. Very thoughts, very important to hold on to. And again, sometimes, you know, there's that wonderful passage in Henry the Second, Shakespeare's play, Henry the Second, where they're going into battle and they're far outnumbered. And Henry the King leads them and he says, "We few, we precious few." And so it is with all of us. We look around and we say, we are but an iota of dust in the vast scheme of humanity. And yet, one small group of people who are committed and believe in what they're doing, who give their life to that cause, make more impact than billions of people running around randomly knocking their heads against Maya. And so we are like the sodbusters. We are like that prow on the ship that sails through icebergs, that breaks the ice, as Jyotish was talking about, of delusion. It doesn't matter the numbers, it's the intensity, as we were speaking of yesterday, and the concentration and the commitment. And this is how our personal evolution can change the global evolution. And it's a beautiful intersection that global evolution is going to happen anyway. But we have a choice now. You know, when Master was a babe in arms, his mother, who was a disciple of Lahiri Mahashaya, took him to her guru's ashram to be blessed. But I love the quality of Indian women. There's such humility and such subtlety and self-effacingness. She just sat in the back of the room, not pushing herself forward, holding her son, Master. And Lahiri looked and called her forward and blessed Master and said, "Little mother, thy son will be a yogi. He will be a great engine who will bring many souls into the kingdom of God." Well, that great engine of Master's consciousness has come, and he has hooked behind him many cars, a train that he can fill with as many people who want to get on board as possible. And we have a ticket on that train. Our good karma has given us a ticket. Our spiritual aspirations from the past have given us that ticket. But now we have the choice. Are we going to get on that train? Or is that train going to move on without us? Master said, the time for knowing God has come. The time to get on the train has come. And we can say, oh, well, not quite yet. Not quite yet. I haven't put everything in my suitcase. I haven't gotten all the things yet that I need in this world. Or we can say, oh, but I have these projects I haven't finished yet, and they're so important. I can't get on that train yet that's going to the kingdom of heaven. Or we can say, oh, but my friends and my family, oh, what will they do without me? I can't get on the train yet. But there's that beautiful story, I think many people weep, I know I do when I hear it, of the devotee, of a man who was so devoted to God that he would, every day in his devotions, would say, Lord, I will come at the very moment you call me. I live in this world. I have work to do. I have a home and a wife. But any moment that you call me, I will come. And he prayed this every day. And time went by, and his wife was due to have a child. And the child was born. But tragically, in that moment, the wife passed away in childbirth. And he picked up that little baby, and his heart was just filled with compassion and desire to protect that child, and not knowing how to go forward. And at that moment, God called him, said, now you must come to me. And the devotee said, Lord, I will come, but I have a human heart. Give me reassurance that this little child who has no one in the world to care for him, that this little child will be cared for. And the Lord said, put the child in a blanket and put it in a little basket and leave it there along the side of this road and stand behind a tree and see what happens. And the man did it as God commanded him. And then as he waited there, he heard the sound in the distance of many horses approaching. And he looked from behind the tree, and he saw that it was the queen of the realm. And that she, there she was in her palanquin with her entourage all around her. And the little baby started crying. And the queen raised her hands to stop. And she motioned to one of her attendants, bring me that basket. And she looked and saw the little baby. She said, look at this beautiful child, all abandoned. I will take this child and raise it as my own. And the man said, Lord, now you have satisfied my heart. I come. But the point was, he would have come anyway. But God satisfied that. So we think, oh, I can't come yet. I can't come yet. The train is moving. It's already out of the station. The momentum is building. And we have the choice to get on that train or not. The global consciousness is changing. We can add our little bit to it or not. It's up to us. But if you have the ticket, if you know where that train is going, let's help each other, everyone, to say, let's get on the train to the kingdom of God. It's why I came. It's why the masters have come. It's where the world is. It's the transition of the world now. So the time for seeking God has, the time for knowing God has come. Why our search? And this has been the theme of our classes this week. The search for God cannot wait, because it's already happening. It's our choice if we want to join the search or not.